Communism and Jeffersonian Democracy. A number of times I've told the story of when I was on a speaking tour and doing media appearances in 1979. I did a particular interview show that was taped in Cleveland with a number of black journalists. And at the end of the program, after we'd finished taping, the woman who was moderating the interview turned to me and very matter-of-factly said, "My, you're awfully brave." And this sort of took me aback, and I asked her, "Why do you say that?" She said, "Well, you know, they kill people for saying what you're saying." And I pointed out a number of times the point of the story, and one of the most significant things about what she said, very matter-of-factly again, is that she didn't even say, "You know, they kill people for trying to do what you're talking about." She said simply, "They kill people for saying what you're saying." And this gets to the essence, which people with a lot of historical experience of what this society is really all about have a very definite sense of, even if not a profound scientific understanding of. What is the real nature of the way in which things are run in this society? What is the real relationship between the people who actually run this society, however people think of that, and the people over whom they rule in running that society, however people understand that? And she was cutting right to the quick and right to the essence of the matter. And this is a reason I repeatedly tell this story, is not only because it hit me very sharply at the time and struck me as something very incisive, but it does, you know, along with that, capture in a very concentrated way some very essential things which a lot of people who have studied a lot of history and compared and contrasted a lot of different kinds of society throughout history have much less of a sense of. There's another way of getting at the same point, interestingly enough. Another one of the ways in which these things jump out at you when you're just reading along. There was a story recently on ESPN.com, the magazine online, by someone by the name of Scoop Jackson, who used to write for Slam Magazine. He's a black guy, probably in his 30s. He's writing about Eton Thomas, who plays basketball for the Washington Wizards. Can't be called the Bullets anymore. Can't have bullets in Washington other than those directed by the government. So he plays for the now Washington Wizards, and he's sort of a role player, as they say. Comes off the bench, scores a few points a game. Has a good game, but he's not a prominent player. But he's a progressive guy, and he stands out in that way. He's spoken at some of the anti-war rallies. He's written poetry condemning the Bush administration and politicians in general, and speaking to the glaring contradiction between the way that they talk about things in society and the way that things actually are, and speaking of its desire to drag them down to the inner cities and force them to see what really goes on there, and so on. So this article by Scoop Jackson is mainly about Eton Thomas's politics. And then in the middle of this article, in speaking about Eton Thomas, he makes the following comment. He says, quote, "Here is a man who, if he averaged 30 points a game, might be dead." Now, he doesn't mean that it's dangerous to score 30 points a game, and the effort, the exertion might kill him. He means that if he were a prominent player on the level of a Michael Jordan or someone like that, capturing that kind of the attention and the imagination of masses of people and saying the things that he's saying, he's not even calling for revolution, but just in the way that he's indicting certain outrages of the system, if he were doing that and that kind of a prominent player, they might very well kill him. Because that's too dangerous even to have someone in that with that level of prominence saying even those kinds of things. So this provides kind of a backdrop for a discussion of the much vaunted freedom and democracy of this society and of this system. And I want to get into this, as the title of this talk suggests, by speaking first and specifically to Jefferson, to Jefferson as, in a real sense, the emblem of what is in fact bourgeois democracy. As Isaac Kramnik and R. Lawrence Moore put it in their book, The Godless Constitution, A Moral Defense of the Secular State, for many people, Jefferson, quote, remains the spokesman of a radical and popular democracy never achieved in America, unquote. In other words, even if many people, many progressive people in particular, can see that there are many flaws in the way democracy is actually practiced in the U.S., they cling to the notion that somehow if this system could actually be made to live up to its ideals, that would be the best of all possible systems, not only in conception but in reality. And they specifically, many of them, cling to Jefferson as the embodiment and personification of, as Kramnik and Moore put it, a radical and popular democracy never achieved in America, but for which they long to see the achievement. In other words, this is a concentration. Jefferson becomes a personification and a concentration of many of the illusions, particularly of the people in the middle strata and more specifically of intellectuals who cling to a bourgeois democratic view of the world. And this is true not only more broadly in the society, but it's even been true, believe it or not, in the history of the communist movement in this country. We have the very startling phenomenon, if you're coming at it from a communist perspective, of the old Communist Party upholding Jefferson as a model. If you went around the country up until the demise of the Soviet Union, at least, for years, if you went looking for the CP, where could you find them? In the CP's Jefferson bookstores. So this is another example of how, in the name of communism, people who claim to be opposed to the system and the capitalism in the U.S. wrap themselves in the mantle of bourgeois democracy. It was what used to be, back in the day, it used to be quite a fun thing to get into a discussion with CP people about why they had Jefferson bookstores. Besides the obvious thing of Jefferson as a slaveholder, there was the whole thing of Jefferson as a representative of the system that you're supposed to be trying to get rid of, by the way. So in this talk, I'm going to examine both some important particulars with regard to Jefferson's views and more generally notions of what is in fact bourgeois democracy, and contrast those views and the general principles of bourgeois democracy with the communist view of freedom and of the kind of society and world we should be striving for and struggling to bring into being. First, I want to speak to a particular of Jefferson's view, which is often upheld by a number of people, his notion of an agrarian model as the concentration of the good and just and virtuous society. Get into that, examine that in some aspects, and then contrast that as we go along with the model of a communist society. In this connection, there are a number of books and writings that are relevant, and I just want to refer to them for people's reference beyond this talk. One is a recent book that I referred to in another talk by Gary Wills called Negro President, Jefferson and the Slave Power. Another is a book by Roger G. Kennedy called Mr. Jefferson's Lost Cause, Land, Farmers, Slavery, and the Louisiana Purchase. A third one is a book I've also referred to previously, Inhuman Bondage, The Rise and Fall of Slavery in the New World by David Bryan Davis. And in particular, I would call attention to Chapter 14, The Politics of Slavery in the United States. Now, here I have to say that Davis, like all too many others these days, in the course of this book, repeats the all too familiar and seemingly de rigueur obligatory anti-communism. An anti-communism that is in no way factual, but frankly fatuous, empty-headed and shallow, swallowing down and regurgitating back up all the crude distortions and slanders of the whole communist project and the experience of socialist countries, speaking of communism as if it's even worse in many ways than classical slavery. The experience not only of the Soviet Union under Stalin, but China under Mao was even worse. All in the midst of what are, in fact, otherwise, important and insightful analysis and insights in the book that are important to learn from. So we've sort of become accustomed to having to, as we're reading along and learning from a lot of these sources, to have to say, okay, as someone was putting it, how many pages is it going to be until we get to the de rigueur anti-communism, you know, and then we just sort of swat that aside for the time being and go on and see what can be learned from what's otherwise often very insightful analysis. And that's the case with Davis's book as well. It shows, as I'll speak to in other contexts also, once again, the great importance of the Setting the Record Straight project and the need for struggle with these people to bring them back to reality and to actually get them to consistently think in a critical way. But to return to the subject at hand, Jefferson's vision of an agrarian society as the model of the good society involved a number of rather sharp ironies, and I want to discuss some of them. The first irony, Jefferson extolled the yeoman, that is the small independent landowning farmer, as the emblem, and the existence of many such farmers as the basis for the best form of government and of a virtuous society. Yet Jefferson consistently acted in the interests of the aristocratic large landowning and slaveholding class, in opposition to those, to the interests of such yeoman small farmers. In reality, Jefferson's agrarian society turned out to be a society based on slavery and ruled by slave owners. One striking example that a number of people have pointed to in this regard is the Louisiana Purchase. Napoleon, having suffered some military defeats, reckoned that he couldn't easily hold on to these territory that was became part of the Louisiana Purchase by the U.S. under Jefferson. And so Jefferson stepped in to quickly grab up this territory, to purchase it. And he did so primarily in the interest of the slave owners and in order to spread the slave-owning system into those new territories, not to develop an agrarian society based on a multitude of small, yeoman, independent farmers. And this is just one example of many that are spoken to in some of those books that I referred to of how Jefferson consistently acted not in the interest of these yeoman small farmers, but in the interest of the slave-owning class, even as not only as against the yeomen, but also their interests in conflict with those of the rising capitalist class in the North. Along with the economic dimension, the whole Southern way of life was one that depended on slavery. That was its fundamental economic basis. Even small landowners who didn't own slaves strived to get into a position to own some. And in a more personal dimension, Jefferson's political fortunes, including his election to the presidency itself, depended on slavery, and in particular, as I've spoken to elsewhere, the three-fifths provision in the Constitution, the so-called three-fifths compromise that said that slaves, for the purposes both of taxation but also of election and representation, would be counted as three-fifths of people. And as many Northerners pointed out at the time, coming from various positions and with various motives, this essentially allowed the Southern states to, by the ownership of property in the form of slaves, accumulate a lot of more votes or representation in the government by the multiplication of this property, which, of course, Northern owners of property, for example, farms or small factories, didn't get to count each factory in terms of how much representation the state would have. But the slave states got to count three-fifths of each of the slave, the total of each all the slaves, in terms of representation in the government. So this tilted things toward the Southern states in terms of the political structure from the beginning of the country. And in fact, if you look into this, you'll see that this was something that the southern states insisted upon, or there would have been no union. There would have been no United States. And even those in the north who, on basis of moral conviction and or economic interest, were opposed to slavery, ended up capitulating to this. Because otherwise the South would have refused to join in the Union and there would have been no United States. Regardless of the war against England and the Declaration of Independence and all that, when it came down to it, this was a sine qua non. This was an absolute requirement for the slave-owning class in the South. And it did involve a compromise, but this compromise embodied the things that I've been speaking to, which gave a certain disproportionate power to the South, to the slave-owning class, and which enabled them to block and counter moves that would have gone in the direction of abolishing slavery. Sometimes it's claimed it's claimed quite often by different people that Jefferson was actually opposed to slavery and wanted to see an end to it. And you can find statements by Jefferson where he says that slavery is in fact a blight and that it will have the consequences down the road and so on, of a negative kind down the road and so on. And also, there have been misinterpretations of what Jefferson wrote about slavery, some of which didn't get into the final version of the Declaration of Independence, where he denounced in strong terms some of it did get in and some of it didn't, but denunciation in strong terms of the King of England and of the British government for supposedly imposing the slave trade on the United States. And there were ways in which Jefferson and the Virginia slave-owning class in particular were opposed to aspects of the slave trade, that is, the international slave trade, because they themselves were involved in selling slaves to other states and slave owners in other territories. And they didn't want the price of a slave being driven down. And this is the reason fundamentally that they were opposed to the continuation, once they did oppose it, of the international slave trade. They view this entirely in property and supply and demand terms. So, in reality, once again on this point, Jefferson acted in the interest of the slave-owning class, and his agrarian society turned out to be a slave-owning plantation society. In reality, not a society of small, independent farming yeomen. Now, this is, of course, related to, in an overall sense, part of the larger contradiction between Jefferson's lofty-sounding statements in the Declaration of Independence about the equality of all men, note all men, and their inalienable rights, and on the other hand, the glaring fact that Jefferson not only owned slaves himself, but, as I pointed to, consistently acted on behalf of the class of slave owners, and in upholding the institution of slavery, even while voicing certain moral qualms and objections to slavery, and recognizing that it strategically embodied many problems and dangers for the new American Republic. This, again, was a very acute contradiction. Historian Edward S. Morgan, in American Slavery, American Freedom, which is cited in David Brian Davis's book, In Human Bondage, argues that for Jefferson and other Virginian slave owners, such as George Washington and James Madison, the latter being the principal author of the U.S. Constitution, and also Madison himself became president of the United States, for figures like this, there was a certain kind of unity, a unity of opposites, as we would say, between how they viewed whites and, on the other hand, black Africans, mulattoes, and Indians. And I'm going to quote from Morgan and give a little explanation of what he's saying here to make it a little clearer. Morgan says, quote, "Racism thus absorbed in Virginia the fear and contempt that men of the upper classes in Europe whether Whig or Tory, that is, today we would say whether liberal or conservative, felt for the inarticulate lower classes of whites or Europeans. In other words, he's saying here that this in Europe there was an open contempt on the part of the upper ruling classes and their political representatives for the inarticulate and ignorant rabble of the lower classes. But in the United States, the same thing did not find exactly the same expression, because a lot of this contempt was, if you want to put it that way, deflected and directed toward the masses of black people who were enslaved, and to, you know, overwhelmingly, especially in the South, and toward mulattoes and Indians. And then Morgan goes on. Racism made it possible for white Virginians to develop, and this is very significant in terms of the whole development of bourgeois democracy in this country. Racism made it possible for white Virginians to develop a devotion to liberty, for whites we should underline, that English Republicans had declared to be the soul of liberty. In other words, because of racism and because of excluding, essentially, from consideration as human beings deserving of freedom, of classes or groups of people such as Africans, mulattoes, and Indians, they could, at the same time, without feeling an acute contradiction, articulate, as Jefferson did in the Declaration of Independence, lofty principles of the equality of and inalienable rights of all people. They were speaking about all white people, and more specifically, all white men, dead or otherwise. And they were explicitly excluding from this these other groups of people that I've referred to, most especially the African people of African origin. And so the one went together with the other. They could feel, in large part exactly because of this exclusion, that they were speaking in a universal way about freedom, even while they represented certain particular interests, certain particular class interests, even among the whites. There was a dialectical unity there. By excluding these other groups, they could feel, even while they represented the interests of the ruling classes among whites, they could feel they were speaking in universal terms about the freedoms for all people who were not excluded, i.e. the whites. This is a very important insight. And then he goes on. He speaks about Republicans, and he doesn't mean the ruling right-wing party in the U.S. today, but people who have a Republican philosophy of government. That is to say, the general political philosophical viewpoint that is opposed, for example, to a monarchy, the best and most just form of government is a republic in which the people are said to be sovereign and have the formal right to vote and elect representatives to government in whatever form that takes place. So these people, in other words, could proclaim Republican principles and believe in them even while practicing and defending slavery as well as other forms of exploitation. And Morgan goes on, by lumping Indians, mulattoes, and Negroes in a single pariah class, that is, putting them in a category of people who were not really to be considered human in terms of the rights and freedoms that human beings should have. By lumping Indians, mulattoes, and Negroes in a single pariah class, Virginians, and here he's speaking about ruling class slave-owning Virginians in particular, Virginians had paved the way for a similar lumping of small and large planters in a single master class. Here again you see the unity between the exclusion of one and the notion of unity of all the others, even with the class divisions among them. And Morgan continues, racism became an essential, if unacknowledged, ingredient of the Republican ideology that enabled Virginians, like Jefferson and Madison as well as Washington, to lead the nation. And this is a peculiarity or particularity of the development of bourgeois society and the principles of bourgeois democracy as they developed from the very beginning and have evolved historically in the United States. As David Bryan Davis summed it up in his recent book on slavery, Inhuman Bondage, quote, according to Morgan, racial slavery enabled Virginia's slave-owning planter class to co-opt the poorer whites and thus perpetuate a highly exploitative and unequal society under the banner of Republican liberty. And this is something very important to understand, not only in terms of the history of the founding of the country and the basis on which it was founded, but in terms of its implications and in terms of its consequences down through the history of the country, even to today. So with whatever limitations there may be in Morgan's and in Davis's overall analysis, there is definitely important truth to the fact that, first of all, the Republican ideology and notions of freedom that have characterized the way in which the United States has been conceived and ruled have indeed included racism and the oppression of black people and others whom today are often called people of color, the exclusion of them from the very beginning, from this notion of freedom, and their oppression from the very beginning and in the very foundation of the country. And there has been a definite tendency for this to contribute in various ways to blunting the overall class conflicts in society and the class consciousness of the proletarians, among the whites in particular, but also in a different way among black people and other oppressed nationalities. So all that's by way of speaking to the first irony that I mentioned, that Jefferson talked about a virtuous yeoman-based agrarian society, but actually in opposition to that, consistently upheld and fought for the interests of the slave-owning class and the agrarian society that in reality he was an embodiment and a spokesperson for was a slave-owning plantation society. Another irony. While Jefferson extolled these yeomen and the notion of a yeoman-based society in the way I've spoken to it, he firmly believed that such yeomen had to be led and headed by members of more elite strata, intellectually and economically, of which Jefferson himself was a representative. And here's an irony within the irony, so to speak. Many of the Jeffersonian Democrats, and bourgeois Democrats more generally, but in particular those who extol and uphold Jefferson and his ideas and ideals as the model of a great society, even if it hasn't yet to be fully achieved, many of them are among those who are very quick to attack communists, and in particular Lenin and what is to be done, for their elitism. They think the masses are too stupid to know what's good for them. They have to have some intellect. Chomsky and others, you'll hear them say this. They think they have to have these intellectuals ordering them about and telling them what's good for them. They're too stupid to know what they really want and need. That's what the communist view is. That's what Lenin was arguing and what is to be done. Well, I don't have time here to go into all the ways in which that's a gross distortion of what Lenin was arguing and what is to be done and how it's, in fact, the essence of what he's arguing is the opposite of that. In fact, he's emphasizing both the ability and the necessity for the masses to consciously grasp the nature of society, the nature of the struggle, and to consciously make revolution. And that's the only way a radical transformation of society can come about. And yes, they need a vanguard to lead them in that, but in order to enable them to do that and not to substitute for them or try to substitute for them in doing that. But here's the irony within the irony that all these Jeffersonian bourgeois Democrats never tire of hurling this charge against the communists and the Leninists, and yet their hero and model, Thomas Jefferson himself, was a firm believer in the idea that the ordinary yeoman needed elite intellectual and economic strata to guide them to the virtuous society, even if he had actually tried to bring such a society into being, which he did not. Yet another irony. If Jefferson's yeoman-based society had in fact been realized, and there are many reasons why it could not have been, but if it in fact had been realized, before very long, it would have given rise to and been supplanted by polarization and the emergence of elites ruling over the quote-unquote common people. If you imagine the attempt to create a society of large in quantity number of farmers, each holding a small in quantity amount of land and farming independently on that land. First of all, there are many different natural conditions, if you will, conditions of the soil, the topography, and other environmental and geological conditions even, which will favor some over others. Even if you look at Virginia, for example, I pointed this out in the Revolution speech, which is on DVD. Why is there a West Virginia? Because when it came to the Civil War, the part of Virginia that was the western part of Virginia has a very different terrain. It's very hilly and rocky. It's got a lot of coal. It's not favorable for small farming or for farming, in general. There is some small farming, but it's not nearly as favorable as some of the other parts of Virginia and other parts of the South, even, with a much richer soil. And then there's the question of how closely related it is, different land is to water and other advantages and so on. So you would have had these differences developing anyway. Even if you'd started out with everybody having approximately the same size farm and many small farmers independently, carrying out family farming with all the patriarchy that goes along with that inevitably. So you would have had these inequalities within these families and family farms, and you would have had developing polarization and inequalities between the different farmers, even if you just took a region of the country like the South, to say nothing of the fact that you had farmlands opening further to the west, you had farms of a different kind in the northeast of the country at its beginning, plus you had international agriculture and world trade, which would have penetrated into all this and would have reacted upon and influenced the polarization already developing. And if somehow you'd had a government that said, okay, let's implement the Jeffersonian model. Everybody has to be a small farmer, or at least not if everybody doesn't have to be, at least the base of the whole economy and the whole society has to be small farmers. And if anybody starts getting much bigger than anybody else, we'll take that land away and give it back so there'll be more equal distribution of small farming throughout the country. Eventually, you would have had to fight wars over that, because those whom you were hindering in that way would have resisted, and if you kept doing it, they would have rebelled in an armed way. Plus, there is the whole world market that's going on. At this point in history, the time of the founding of the U.S., I mean, where was the southern cotton and tobacco and other products or sugar, where were they going? To a large degree, to the world market, to Europe and other places. You would have had to stop everybody from producing for the world market. Because if they produced for the world market, the inequality would have been reinforced as well. Different ones would have done better, would have found a more favorable market at any given time for their whatever product these farmers were growing. And that would have reacted upon and intensified the polarization that was already developing. You would have had to step in with the government and militarily shut off the country from the world market. In other words, to put it simply, it would have been totally impractical and unrealizable. Even if you'd started out on that basis, you couldn't have maintained it. Fundamentally, because this was all in the context of commodity production and exchange. And there are two things to single out about that in this context. One, commodity production and exchange inevitably leads to inequality, to polarization, for some of the reasons I've been speaking to. And the general operation of the commodity system means that there is inequality. It means that some do better in competition than others. It means that polarization develops. And what goes along with that, the second thing is that labor power itself will become a commodity. Some farmers will not, and you see this happening even today, many farmers will no longer be able to make it as farmers and will have to hire out to others who are doing better at farming or something else and become wage workers themselves. And so that unique commodity that produces more wealth in its use, labor power, the ability to work, will also be produced on a larger and larger scale. More, or another way of saying it, more and more people will be reduced the position of wage workers having to sell their ability to work, their labor power, in order to live. So you'll get that polarization of capitalist and wage worker, along with the great unevenness that continues to develop even among the landowning class, broadly speaking. And when you add in the world market once again, all this becomes much greater, much further accentuated. So along with the glaring contradiction between Jefferson's proclamations about how all men are created equal and with certain inalienable rights on the one hand, and not only the fact of his being a slave owner, but his repeated actions, including his president, on behalf of the whole slave-owning class, these ironies, all of them, which I have identified here, are contradictions. Ironies are contradictions. And these in particular are contradictions. And these contradictions that I've pinpointed and spoken to here are in turn an expression of the fundamental contradictions in all societies between the forces and relations of production and between the economic base at any given time and the superstructure of politics, including political institutions, structures, and processes, and of ideology. So we can see in looking at what Jefferson wrote in a few places in his Notes on Virginia and elsewhere about the model of a good and virtuous society in conflict with the kind of society he actually upheld and fought for, we can see on all this some profound lessons about the nature of republican government as a bourgeois democracy and about the nature of bourgeois democracy itself in general, and also more particularly the actual expressions this took in the history of the United States with the quote-unquote peculiar institution of slavery in particular for nearly the first 100 years of the country. So let's talk more about slavery and freedom in the history of the U.S. Now there is a more or less semi-official narrative about the history and the greatness of America. And this narrative, you've all heard it in different forms, we all are familiar with it, is that the greatness of America lies in the freedom and ingenuity of its people, and above all in a system that gives encouragement and reward to these qualities, such as freedom and ingenuity. Now, in opposition to this semi-official narrative about the greatness of America, the fact is, to take one fundamental aspect of things, slavery was an indispensable part of the base of the freedom and prosperity of the U.S. from its very foundation. And this freedom and prosperity that's so loudly proclaimed, and the combination of the two is, as we know, still today, and in some ways today more than ever, proclaimed as the unique quality and the special destiny and mission of the United States and its role in the world. And this stands in stark contradiction to the fact that without slavery, none of this, even the bourgeois democratic freedoms, let alone the prosperity, none of this would have been possible, not only in the southern United States, but in the north as well, in the country as a whole, and in its development and emergence as a rich and powerful country. I've spoken earlier and elsewhere to the way in which slavery was an integral part of the whole development of the U.S. and of the development of its economic and ultimately military strength over the whole period of time. Even, for example, the way in which agriculture in the South developed to be as profitable as it was obviously directly related to and founded on the system of slavery. Even the way in which the U.S. related to the world market and built up its prosperity and economic base in that way was to a very large degree dependent on slave-based production. Even the interchange back and forth between the development of manufacture in the north and the development of agriculture in the south, for example, even when that went indirectly through the world market and through England, for example, where something like cotton would be sold to the textile mills in England and other products would be sold from England to the northern manufacturers in the U.S., even that, for example, would not have happened in the way and on the kind of scale it did and with the prosperity that it evolved to involve without slavery. There is no United States as we now know it today without slavery. That's not the only factor that went into it. There's the theft of land, as I've spoken to, both from Mexico and from the native peoples. But even much of that, for a long period of time, up till the Civil War, was to expand the slave system. The great Alamo. You know, many of the heroes of the Alamo were slave traders and slave chasers. Forget all that Davy Crockett, you know, Green Estate and the Land of the Free stuff that some of us heard on the TV as kids. These were slave chasers and slave enforcers and adventurers expanding the slave system to a large degree. And that's what, whatever they were as individuals, that's the essence of what that war was about. The grabbing of Texas was essentially to expand the slave system. And the stealing this huge territory from Mexico was to a large degree about expanding the slave system, although it was also to expand the capitalist system into those territories. And these two systems were even in competition with each other over that, as well as in an overall way. Now, a different United States, or something entirely different altogether, might have evolved in the same territory, or roughly the same territory, but the United States that did evolve could not have evolved and would not have reached the position it did had it not been for centuries of slavery, even before the founding of the country, and for nearly 100 years of slavery afterward. So whenever we talk about freedom in this country, think back of those quotes that I read from that Edmund Morgan. You always have to think of it in dialectical relation. Even when we're talking about actual bourgeois democratic rights, you always have to understand it in dialectical relation to slavery in the very foundation of the country. Even in that more limited context, as well as in the overall sense of what the country became and how it developed. And this is a fundamental point that those who want to base themselves on idealist notions of Jeffersonian democracy need to be confronted with and need to be engaged and struggled with over in a very lofty way, but also a very sharp way. Because there are big things at stake in terms of how you understand this. This is not abstract history. People are taught that, you know, especially in this country with its instant gratification ethos, you know, anything that happened last week, let alone last year or a couple of centuries ago, is totally irrelevant to whatever I'm going to consume tomorrow or whatever. But this is conditioning by the ruling class, and the actually understanding history and waging the struggle about how to scientifically and correctly understand history is a crucial part of the overall struggle over the whole direction of society and, in a very real sense, the direction of the world as a whole, especially given the role that U.S. imperialism now plays in the world. Really grasping what are the fundamental things about the nature of this society and the way it's historically evolved, that's of crucial importance in being able to wage the struggle to radically transform this society and in order to win more and more people to understand the need to do so and the impossibility of building a just and virtuous, whatever that means, society on the basis of Jeffersonian principles, whether one looks at them as having been realized or not, or whether one looks at them as being realizable or not. Today, the wealth and power of the U.S. rests on a worldwide system of imperialism that ensnares hundreds of millions and ultimately billions of people in conditions hardly better than those of the slaves. Now, this might seem like an extreme or extravagant claim, but think about the fact of tens of millions of children throughout the third world, for example, who from the age of 9 or 10, for example, are working every day of the week. As the slaves used to say, from can't see in the morning till can't see at night, until they've been physically used up, till their life has literally passed from them into the machinery on which they're working, or which is working on them at the same time, and into the products which they are producing through this labor on this machinery. These are conditions very similar to outright slavery. And they often go along with superstructural expression, which are very close to slavery. Ways in which their lives, even outside of or beyond or along with the work they do, are controlled and limited and confined and degraded. Obvious things like sexual harassment, but many other ways as well. This is what the foundation of this whole system continues to rest on. It takes form within the U.S. itself for millions, even tens of millions, but it takes place on a worldwide scale for hundreds of millions and billions of people. While, for example, in large parts of Africa, which was raided for slaves and traded, who were traded on the international market for centuries, the effects of these centuries of the theft and trading in slaves on an international scale continue to be felt in the continent of Africa, especially but not only in those places where the slave trading was most concentrated. And masses of people are maintained in conditions of horrible suffering through the workings of yet again the same imperialist system. Even those who are not directly exploited, for example, by capital, are through the overall operation of a capitalist system, not only economically, but also in the superstructure, politically and militarily, and reinforced ideologically, maintained through all this in conditions of horrible suffering, often regarded as just so much human waste. Recently, there was an article about Angola, where there was an attempt at a revolution, which I spoke to in another talk back in the 70s, What's happened, on the one hand, the oil companies have moved in and they're plundering the oil of Angola, while in the cities of Angola, there was, even in the bourgeois press, an article describing or attempting to describe almost indescribable conditions of suffering. Children playing, sliding down piles of waste and garbage and human waste, surrounded by rivulets containing human waste and garbage. Imagine the impact on the health of these children and on the people generally. This is the foundation on which the prosperity and quote-unquote freedom of the capitalist imperialist system in the world today rest. And as I've said, conditions of brutal exploitation continue within the U.S. itself in a very acute way for immigrants, millions of them from the third world, and others in what Lenin referred to as the lower and deeper sections of the proletariat. Yes, right within the U.S. itself. And this takes us back again to Marx's comment on the rosy dawn of capitalist accumulation, based in slavery and the chasing of slaves, based on the burying alive of what he called the aboriginal or the native population in the mines of Bolivia, based on intensive exploitation of child labor. Today, this continues and exists on an international scale, on an even bigger scale than it did at the time of the rosy dawn of capitalism. The world and the world's people are even more tightly bound together and enmeshed in the dynamics of capitalist accumulation with all of its ruthlessness, which does not derive from the particular greediness of this or that individual or group of capitalists, but from the very laws and dynamics of capitalist accumulation itself. And this is also something that's extremely important to grasp ourselves and to struggle with others to understand. This is poured into the very functioning of this whole system. And if you listen to the capitalists themselves and their explanations and even their rationalizations for why they function as they do, they will tell you some of the truth. Even these large aggregates of capital controlling billions of dollars are involved in intense rivalry with others doing the same. And the cheapening of the cost of production, especially through the more intensive and extensive exploitation of human labor, is absolutely necessary for them. Yes, they will chase the most profitable conditions regardless, but they are driven to do so by the intense competition on a gigantic scale in today's imperialist world between aggregations of capital. And even today, gigantic aggregations of capital lose out and go under if they do not more ruthlessly and relentlessly exploit people in the kinds of conditions that I've been speaking of. And this is the foundation, and these are the dynamics of the prosperity and the freedom that's so loudly proclaimed as the special nature of the American society, the American people, and the American character with their ingenuity and inventiveness and restless pursuit of something new and more money. And next, I want to speak to Jefferson, notions of Lockean liberty, referring to John Locke, and opinions and conscience as private property. While Jefferson did speak at times of an agrarian-based society as the model of a good and virtuous society, and I examined in the course of this talk so far what this actually meant and essential contradictions bound up with this, but this does not mean that Jefferson believed that the good society should be based on or involve only agriculture. Jefferson's view encompassed the need not only for other pillars of an overall economy, but he also argued that private ownership in all these spheres was essential for the good society and was bound up with his notions of freedom. Once again, as Kramnik and Moore point out, Jefferson wrote that, quote, agriculture, manufacture, commerce, and navigation, the four pillars of our prosperity, are the most thriving when left free to individual enterprise, unquote. And Kramnik and Moore speak to how for Jefferson, and we could add for James Madison, the principal author of the U.S. Constitution, rights such as freedom of speech and the basic philosophical concept of freedom of conscience were bound up with the notion of the inviolability of private property. Kramnik and Moore point to something which I also noted in the short pamphlet, The U.S. Constitution and Exploiter's Vision of Freedom. Madison regarded the protection of property as one of the most essential functions of the state. And we should note, for Madison and for the U.S. for nearly 100 years, one of the most important forms of that property was human beings. And Madison was explicit about this. He himself was a slave owner and a defender of the slave system. He regarded the protection of property as one of the most essential functions of the state. And then Kramnik and Moore go on to make the more particular and extremely important point that for Madison as well as Jefferson, quote, opinions and conscience were also sacred forms of individual property, unquote. Now, this is a very, an extremely important point, and we should pause and look at this briefly. This, of course, is bound up with the whole idea that we hear, encapsulated in the phrase we hear so often, the free marketplace of ideas. This has the virtue, if you will, of being rather explicit. It even includes the term market. So we don't have to dig too much to see how this notion of individual conscience and the expression of ideas is bound up with concepts of individual ownership and market principles and ultimately capitalism and its commodity production and exchange. So this is extremely important. For Madison as well as Jefferson, opinions and conscience were also sacred, inviolable forms of individual property. And we see this today, you know, all the battles over intellectual property. We see it not only in the U.S., but on an international scale. We see it very directly impacting the lives of people where, for example, firms based in the U.S. will develop a genetic basis of producing a certain crop, and then they will work to impose that means of agriculture into another country, supplanting and disrupting the more traditional production of the farmers there in that particular country, making it impossible for them to continue agriculture in the traditional way, and then forcing them to pay to get the intellectual property rights to reproduce the genetically based agricultural product, or if not to get the rights, to get to in effect rent the ability to do that, because that has now become the intellectual property right of this gigantic corporation based in a country like the U.S. And obviously millions of people's lives are disrupted and ruined through this process. So this is not just an abstract concept of opinions and conscience being sacred forms of individual property. This has tremendous and devastating consequences for masses of people, millions and even hundreds of millions of people ultimately throughout the world. But let's speak to the philosophical concept briefly of the free marketplace of ideas. And how does that contrast with the communist view of the pursuit of the truth and the contention of opposing views as an essential part of the pursuit of the truth? And here we get around to, once again, to John Stuart Mill, and in a certain way we could say Mill, yes and no. From our point of view, it is crucial to actually understand reality in its motion and development in order to be able to transform it increasingly in the interests of the broad mass of people and ultimately humanity as a whole. And there is a need for contesting of different ideas and different notions and approaches in the attempt to understand reality in order to get most deeply to a correct understanding of that reality. Yes, there is a principle that it's important that people be able to express their ideas and not feel a heavy breath breathing down on them if their ideas are nonconformist, unconventional, or go up against the status quo, whatever that status quo might be. That is actually an important principle that we should understand deeply and uphold and fight for. However, at the same time, from the communist point of view, this is all part of a process of not just a few individuals, but of masses of people getting to the truth of things in many different particular spheres and in a larger sense, and being able to act in accordance with an actual and scientific understanding of reality as it really is, so to speak. And the notion of opinions as conscience and conscience as individual or private property ultimately, and sometimes not so ultimately, gets in the way of that. There is a vast qualitative and extremely important distinction, a profound difference, in other words, between viewing, understanding the importance of the battle of ideas, of the importance of not suppressing unpopular or unconventional ideas in order to have the richest process and in order to feel it, for the people to feel that they have air to breathe and room to be different and to express different ideas as part of an overall process of the kind of society that we want to live in and that mass of people would want to live in, and in order to arrive at the truth in fundamental terms. But there's a vast difference between that and the notion that any individual's ideas are their private property and are set up in competition with others with their ideas. And all this should contest in a marketplace of ideas to see which one can, to put it rather crudely, command the highest price. Not which one can contribute the most to get to the truth, and not just the way in which this will help to create the right atmosphere for the kind of society we want, but who will benefit the most in the contest of different ideas. And that's where you get the notions and the practice of intellectual property rights. It flows from the philosophical conception of opinions and conscience as private property. And when you have individuals holding ideas as private property, the greater social good is going to be interfered with and hindered, just as it is generally in the exchange of and production and exchange of commodities. People will hold back their ideas if they think it will benefit them to not bring them forward at a given time. Everybody who's familiar, for example, with copywriting, things like that, knows the ways in which people come forward with inventive ideas will hold them back before somebody else steals them. There are many stories of how individuals have brought forward creative ideas. They've been grabbed up by bigger corporations who got the rights to them. So in that kind of an environment, you're going to, yes, put forward your ideas, but you're also going to guard them and try to get the best price for them. You're going to view yourself in competition with others. And even if this doesn't take a crude monetary and economic expression, philosophically, the concept of this being your idea as opposed to an idea, which is important in a larger context and ultimately for humanity, those things come into conflict. This idea of this being your idea has negative influences and consequences in how you treat your own idea and how you view mixing it up with other people. To put it in sort of psychological terms, if you will, your ego gets involved in it. Is what's important what's actually true and whether your idea contributes to people understanding things, or is what's important is that it's your idea? There's hardly anyone, if there is anyone, who has not experienced these kinds of sentiments. Sad to say, but not surprising, even among the ranks of the communists. So there's a great difference between the positive side of John Stuart Mill, for example, in arguing that ideas should not be suppressed because they're unpopular, that it's important that people hear ideas articulated not merely by those who oppose them, however fairly they may strive to characterize them, but that they hear them articulated by those who are ardent advocates of those ideas. There's a difference between that principle, which, as we've emphasized, has important application and something that we have to make an important part of the overall process of revolution and transforming society and getting to a new world that we're all about. But there's a profound difference between that and the notion of the free marketplace of ideas. The contention of ideas should be unfettered by notions and by realities of markets and marketplaces, competition and commodity relations. One of the great things, we do talk about the limitations and problems and errors, but one of the great things, for example, about the cultural works that were produced during the Cultural Revolution in China was that it's explicitly and very enthusiastically on the part of the people involved was a process that consciously strove to overcome these notions of individual ownership of ideas or of creativity. It's not that individuals and their creativity didn't contribute, but they contributed it to a larger process. Now, to be clear, this is not to say that every, you know, I made this point in the discussion with that artist who came up with a formulation, solid core with a lot of elasticity. There are a lot of ways in which, in order to get a lot of creativity expressed, you do have to let people go off and, quote unquote, do their own thing. I said to him, as I've recounted before, could you write poetry if you had a party cadre standing over your shoulder examining it at every point? He said, no fucking way. Well, there's a reality to that. And the kind of society and world we want is not one in which that's happening. Let's have the check to make sure it's in accord with the party line at every given point. There's room, and there must be room, expansive space, for a lot of creativity, including unconventional and nonconformist creativity, including that which goes up against whatever's the prevailing thing in a socialist society. But that can be developed on a much broader and richer scale the more it is increasingly unfettered from notions of the free marketplace of ideas, the exchange of commodities and ideas, and the notion ultimately of opinions and conscience being sacred forms of individual property. Now, without lapsing into all these postmodernist theories of literature and so on, in which basically the text has no meaning and it's whatever anybody reads into it, and so there are multitudes of meanings and so on and so forth, it is a fact that works of art, for example, except for those which are literally created by the artist only for himself or herself, which are decidedly the minority, most of them are meant to go out to the world to make some kind of statement or other. However consciously or fully or not, the artist understands that himself or herself. They are meant to go out into the world and to interact with other people and to affect other people in various ways. And that can be done much more fully and richly, while on the one end, yes, giving a lot of initiative to individual creativity, but at the same time breaking this loose from notions and practices that embody the free marketplace of ideas and commodity production and exchange and the competition that goes along with that and the thinking that's bound up with that. So there is, yes, and there must be in socialists and in communist society in an even fuller way, a recognition of the importance of individual conscience. Of the right, if you will, and of the scope, in a broader sense, for people to pursue an understanding of reality and to create various works of art and other and literature and so on, which express a particular view of a part of reality in the way that they seek to do that. There's an important, and there must be an important role and broad scope for that, both as a thing that's important in itself and also in a broader and deeper sense as part of the overall search to understand and change the world in both dimensions. And there is importance to having broad scope not only for the rights of individuals, but in a broader sense for individuality and individual expression, and to make this ultimately serve the greater societal good in the correct way without suppressing or suffocating it. All this as part of the objective of advancing to and then continuing to advance in the conditions of communism. But this is very different from and will be much more fully expressed the more that it moves beyond notions of individual conscience and individual creativity as private property, which inevitably means in conflict and competition with other embodiments of private property. Just as in an overall sense and in a fundamental sense, the advance to communism means and must mean moving beyond the sphere of bourgeois right, moving beyond the sphere of commodity production and exchange and everything bound up with that, so it must and will mean that in the way that I've been speaking to it, and not in a constraining and suffocating sense, not in a negatively constraining and suffocating sense, it must mean moving beyond bourgeois right in relation to individual conscience, individuality, individual ideas, and individual creativity. And that's a very radically different and much better concept, much more better meaning, much more in line with the interests of humanity and the kind of society that the great majority and ultimately all of humanity would thrive in, than the notion of the free marketplace of ideas and the notion, as Madison Jefferson held it, founded in the principles of John Locke, for example, of opinions and conscience as sacred forms of individual property. That's the end of the first section of this talk.